Okay, good. Now, today we're going to be talking about the philosopher who's the most influential political philosopher of the 20th century, and also 21st century, so as much of it as we've had, John Rawls. There have been thousands of articles written about Rawls. And I think it's a bit odd that, you know, when those of us who are libertarians, I assume most people in this course would be, you know, we studied people like Mises, Rothbard, Hayek, Henry Hazlitt, but these people aren't studied in most contemporary political philosophy philosophy departments. But they would study Rawls. It doesn't matter, curiosity, how many people here have studied Rawls or read Rawls in your conferences, in your courses? Is this someone you're familiar with? A little bit of him. Yes. I mean, this is one that's really important to know if you're going to do any work in the political philosophy. Now, I should say, according to Roderick Long, who was a student in Rawls' undergraduate class, he says that Rawls was the most boring lecturer he's ever heard in his life. And he's heard some of mine, so it must be quite a claim. I never met Rawls. I heard him give a couple of lectures. I didn't think he was, MR can't hear me. I hope you can get a better connection. Okay, so they're saying I didn't find Rawls such a boring lecture, but yes, we did just start. But some people find him very boring, but his writing style was he wrote in a very organized way. He isn't the most interesting writer, but as we'll see, he had a gift of coming up with memorable phrases. In his best-known book, which is the one that made him famous, is A Theory of Justice, that came out in 1971. And he wrote several other books, but the other important one we have to be considering to get a full picture of what he was doing is a book called Political Liberalism, that came out in 1993, because in that book he clarified and extended what he had in mind in his project in Theory of Justice. So it's important, if you're studying Rawls, to read these two books together, Theory of Justice in 1971, and this later one, Political Liberalism. Now, what does he mean by justice? He says a theory of justice. He says that justice is the primary virtue of social institutions. And here I think he means something like, justice would be the basic framework setting up what rights people have in the society. Here it would be quite similar to the way libertarians think of things, where we think of rights as being things that you can do that you have the power, you're free to do them, and people. You can use force to enforce these rights. There are other aspects of morality that might be nice things to do, but the structure of rights is basic. This says what is the permissible use of force? What are the really basic institutions of society? So here, I think when you talk about justice, you're saying what is the basic framework we should establish in the society? What are the rights we should establish? Of course, this raises the key question, how do we decide what is just? How will we decide on what this basic framework is? I see we have a question here. Aiden has an interesting question here. Should an institution first doing what it's supposed to do as opposed to equitably? But you see, just as these institutions has to be doing certain things, but it has to do it in a certain framework that doesn't violate the rights of others. And so we want to know what that framework is, don't we? I don't think we want to say it's not a question of which it comes first, which has temporal priority, but what we're trying to do here is establish what are the rights people have in the society within those structured rights, and they can pursue their own productive activities. So I don't think we would want to say, well, people have to do productive activities before we find out what the structured rights is. No, we want to know what the structured rights is, so then we know in what framework will they be pursuing this project. So it's a very interesting question, so I don't think I'd agree with that. So then, if you accept that it's an interesting question anyway, it's a good question, but if justice is what we're trying to establish is a framework, basic framework, right? How do we decide what is just? Well, Rawls says we don't start out empty-handed. It isn't the case, I suppose, we said that if we want to establish what is the atmosphere on Mars, that we just have to go in and we don't know right until we go in and investigate. So Rawls says we got in this question of what is justice or what is the basic framework, we don't start off empty-handed. We have judgments, which moral philosophers call intuitions, about particular cases. I mentioned this before, but the term intuition is somewhat misleading, but you think sometimes an intuition is kind of a hunch, like I have an intuition the brick is going to fall on my head in the next few minutes. I just have a hunch that's going to happen. I hope I'm wrong, but I just have this hunch. That isn't what philosophers mean by intuition. Intuition is just a judgment on a particular case. For example, suppose someone came up with a theory of justice, and it was a consequence of this theory that slavery was all right, that slavery was justifying certain cases. So then we want to say, well, there's something wrong with the theory because we know that slavery's wrong. We haven't established necessarily through some moral theory that slavery's wrong. Maybe we do have something like that, but we don't have to have it. We just make the judgment that slavery's wrong. So then we can test moral theories that we can come up. Do they conform to this judgment? If they go against some intuitive judgment that we have, some judgment about some basic case that we have, then we can be pretty sure there's something wrong with the theory. Now, Rawls doesn't go as far as some people who push this line. Some people emphasize these moral judgments or intuitions a great deal. Michael Humer is a very good philosopher at Colorado University. I'll just push his name down so you can get this. He's a very good philosopher who emphasizes quite libertarian views. And you know, he emphasizes intuitions a great deal. He says, well, a theory can never go against any of our intuitions. But Rawls doesn't go that far. He says, you can challenge these intuitions in particular cases. Suppose you had a good theory of justice that explains a lot of, seems to be a very convincing account of what the basic framework of society should be. It conforms to most of the intuitions that we have. It doesn't come up with judgments, say that slavery's all right. It's in accord with our basic intuitions, but maybe it does come into conflict with some of our intuitions. Then Rawls said we might not want to reject the theory. Maybe we could reject one of the intuitions, or we could modify either the theory or the intuition. We would kind of adjust the theory and intuition so we got a fit. So we have a theory, and we're trying to test it by these judgments we have about morality, trying to come up with a good fit so we can modify either the theory or the intuitions. We try to come up with stuff so we get something that we're satisfied with. And Rawls calls this process of adjustment reflective equilibrium. We're trying to balance the theory against the intuition. That's why he calls it equilibrium. We're trying to reach a state where we're satisfied. Certainly, economists talk about equilibrium. Maybe Austrian economists don't like that word, but they have the same concept. You're trying to come up, you're adjusting supply and demand till there is no the price that the supply and demand equals quantity supplied. So you have an equilibrium there. So here it's the same sort of thing. You're testing the intuition and the theory, against the theory, and you're adjusting till you're satisfied with the way they fit. And according to a philosopher who was very influential when Rawls was writing, Nelson Goodman, this is the way science proceeds by this having the theories and then the empirical data, and we adjust one to the other. We don't always reject the theory just because there are a few items in fact that doesn't seem to fit. If it's a good enough theory, we can maybe think that the facts will somehow come up. We'll be able to explain the facts that don't fit in some other way. So we don't always reject the theory completely if it doesn't fit some of the facts. We adjust one to the other. But we sat down, Nelson Goodman thought science proceeded. Rawls, I think, got the term reflective equilibrium from him. So that's the general way Rawls thinks we could argue about how we would try to come up with a theory of justice. We try to come up with a general theory, and then we can test it against our judgment in particular cases, or against our moral intuition. Now, there's one theory of morality, I mentioned this before when I talked about Michael Singer, that is a bit different from Rawls, although it relies on intuitions much. This theory is that we directly grasp values for moral truth, and there's no systematic account connecting these truths. So on this account, we don't have to worry about reflective equilibrium. We don't have to say, well, how do we adjust a general theory to these judgments about the particular cases? On this intuitionist account, all we have are judgments about particular cases. We don't have any general theory at all. Now, this theory is called intuitionism, or Rawls sometimes called it rational intuitionism. So we just see or grasp that certain things are wrong or right. And there were two British philosophers in the wrote, say, around in the 1920s through 40s, were very influential, W.B. Ross or David Ross and H.A. Pritchard. They were probably the leading intuitionists. And Rawls is not an intuitionist in this sense, although he does believe in testing theories by the judgments about cases. But he's not an intuitionist in this sense because he believes it is possible to come up with a general theory of justice. So he says, well, we do have these all sorts of judgments about particular cases we can use to test our theory, but that doesn't mean just because we have these judgments of particular cases that we can't have any general theory that accounts for these cases, of general theory explaining why certain things are right to adjust. So you see the difference there between Rawls using intuition, but he's not an intuitionist. Now, one reason I've been going on quite a bit about now we have a question here from Lucas. Isn't it only intuition if you can't explain why? Yes, that's right. See, the intuitions would say, all you have are the judgments. There isn't any explanation. They didn't just think that was because they couldn't come up with any. They just thought more judgments, or just judgments in particular, these particular cases, that we could have certain principles, but there'd be no way of relating these principles systematically. So then Aidan asked a very good question. Is overall coherence the criterion? Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. You'd be coming up with it. You'd be balancing the theories against the intuitions in a way that gave you a satisfying fit. That would be a very good way of putting things. And now, I don't want to get caught up too much in these questions, but the intuitions are not supposed to be subjective. That, I was trying to go into that a bit before. They're not just feelings or that we have about things. They're considered judgments. They're something like, suppose we say slavery is wrong. It isn't just that we're feeling that I don't like slavery very much. We're making a judgment it's wrong. We think it's really the case that slavery is wrong. So it wouldn't be subjective in the sense that we're just making it up, or we're just expressing their own feeling. Of course, there's some people who think that's all moral judgments are. They're just expressions of feeling. But then they're just rejecting this whole enterprise we're engaging in, trying to figure out what the correct moral theory is and what are true moral judgments. They're just saying, no, you can't do that. So we're presupposing that that account isn't true. There's more truly judgment than just subjective preferences. Now, one reason I've been just emphasizing moral intuitions, why I think it's very important in studying Rawls, is because one such intuition that Rawls has lies at the basis of his rejection of libertarianism. He doesn't mention the word libertarianism, but he does talk about what he calls the system of natural liberty, which is fairly close to libertarianism. So he doesn't accept it. Now, why not? Well, in a capitalist or free market economy, people are usually very unequal in income and wealth. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people who have a great deal more money than I do, which is certainly an unfair state of affairs. We don't want this. So Rawls thinks that other things being held constant, this is a morally bad state of affairs, that people are very unequal. So he's not just saying here, well, it's very bad, it's morally bad, there are some people who are starving, or some people that can't afford medical care for themselves, and they die of illnesses that could be treated. He's going further than that. He thinks that it's a bad state of affairs, but just that some people are vastly wealthier than others. And he thinks that equality has an intuitive moral appeal. So if you have a system that allows for vast inequality, and that doesn't have any further justification for it, just that, you know, it's fine, people can come up with the system allows unlimited inequality, he thinks that would be a big strike against such a system. So he would say, look, you libertarians talk about the free market, but then it's generating this state of affairs where you have vast inequalities. So he has judgment this is a bad state of affairs. And here's libertarians, of course, would be unlikely to agree with this. You could imagine libertarians thought equality is a good thing morally, but just that people don't have the right to forcibly establish equality. But most libertarians don't take that view. Most libertarians say, well, as long as people are free to engage in whatever transactions they want, it doesn't of others, it's perfectly morally all right if you come up with unequal outcomes. So this is the basic difference between law and libertarian. So he's going to be judging the system with libertarian favor by a judgment that we don't accept. Now, suppose then we go on to this task and say, well, we want to come up, we're not satisfied just with intuition, we want to come up with some sort of general theory of morality, or general theory of justice. It, at the time Rawls was writing, the most theory of justice, which 1971, the most popular theory at the time he wrote was utilitarianism. And we'll see how all the emphasis on testing the theory by our moral intuitions enabled him to reject utilitarianism. Now, what do we mean by utilitarianism? Well, as Rawls takes it, it says we should maximize the good. So we're trying to come up with, say, what should we do in any situation would be what would have the best consequences overall, what would maximize the good. And there are different views about what the nature of good is that give you different varieties of utilitarianism. For example, Bentham said we should maximize pleasure. One is that we should just go by what people's preferences are, just take whatever choices they make, and then how could we arrange what action we took would result in the greatest number of people satisfying their most highly valued preferences. Or we could make another variation would be we would take preferences under certain constraints. Let's say we said, well, we should take the try to maximize the preferences that people would have if they were not making any mistakes in thinking or if they were fully informed. There are all sorts of variations on this, but you get the general idea. This type of utilitarianism is talking about maximizing the good in some sense. Now, Rawls's objection to this is that it doesn't take seriously the separation between people. Rawls said, well, each person has certain rights. You can't sacrifice one person for others. But if you're talking about, well, what would have the best consequences overall, in some cases it seems you would be able to sacrifice some on behalf of others. I want to say here's a famous case is suppose there's a riot that's going to happen. Some people, there's a mob that's outraged in a small town. They're outraged about crime. And they're planning to lynch all sorts of people. They're just going to go on a rampage and start killing people. But a sheriff knows that if he hangs one person, he'll be able to stop the crowd from going on this rampage and killing all these people. This would somehow calm them down. So let's suppose, though, that the person he's hanging hasn't done anything, he's innocent, but somehow the crowd thinks he's guilty and they want him hanged. If the sheriff hangs him, then they'll just go away and they won't kill all these other people. So it seems like if you're talking about, well, what would have the best consequences, then wouldn't you have to say it would be all right for the sheriff to hang this person? So it seems like you'd be saying there you're justified in sacrificing this, the life of this innocent person, just because it would maximize the total good. So Rawls says, no, this isn't right. You can't do it. And how does he know it's not right? Well, he's just relying on his moral judgment. What he was saying in this case, the sheriff shouldn't hang the innocent man. So he isn't that he's deduced from some theory. that the sheriff shouldn't do that, just that this is the judgment that we have, so there's something really wrong with utilitarian. Now, just as a side matter, probably the objection most of you or those of you who are familiar with Austrian economics might make an additional objection to this kind of utilitarian. It's like we're trying to maximize, we're trying to add up people's utility, come up with a course of action that has the best overall consequence. We would want to say, look, you can't measure interpersonal utility, you can't add up utilities in this way. So this seems like an additional objection, but the odd point, or at least maybe it's a bit odd, I think, is that Rawls didn't accept this at all. He thought you could measure interpersonal utility, or you could make interpersonal utility comparison, but he just thought that utilitarianism should be rejected for this reason, that it doesn't take seriously the separation between people. Now, I should say, Rawls' criticism of utilitarianism doesn't apply, I think, to the type of utilitarianism supported by Mises. And just mentioned that Danny Sanchez and I were planning a course on comparing Mises' utilitarianism and Murray Rothbard's natural law foundation for libertarianism. So I think it's interesting. Unfortunately, I think Rawls wasn't familiar with Mises' utilitarianism, so he didn't really consider it. But we can see that what he said about utilitarianism doesn't apply to the system Mises was advocating, because all Mises says is that people benefit from social cooperation through the free market, but Mises doesn't call for maximizing adding up utilities to try to get the best overall consequence. In fact, because you can't do that, he thinks you can't measure interpersonal utility, and he doesn't call for sacrificing some to help others. So what Rawls, as I say, didn't consider this, but we could ask, well, what would happen if he did, if he had considered this, what could he say about Mises' grand utilitarianism, just that social cooperation through the free market is the really essential, is the basis for human happiness. I think he could accept this, but he could say, well, it leaves some questions unanswered, such as what should be the initial distribution of wealth, or are transfers of wealth ever justifiable? So he could say, all right, you're perfectly right that we need the market to establish basic to social cooperation, but still we have other questions about justice that we need my theory to answer. So at least that would be a claim. Now, so we then rejected utilitarianism, or at least the type of utilitarianism that he considered, this kind of recession and utility. So now he wants to go on, he's rejected that. So how do we then come up with a theory of justice? Now, he thinks there's a big problem in constructing a theory of justice. If you consider a society like the United States, people disagree on the nature of the good. We have all sorts of people. We have Christians, or other people in other religions who have a certain conception of the good. We have people who don't believe in religion at all. We have all sorts of theories around. People have all sorts of different ideas on what is needed for a good life. We have enormous variations among people on what their conception of good is. So people disagree on what is a good life, what is the best way of living. And it's crucial, the reason is you could say, well, couldn't we just imagine a society where people didn't have these differences? But it's crucial to understand, and this is one thing that Rawls made clear in this later book I mentioned, Political Liberalism, the one that came out in 1993, that he thinks his theory of justice applies only to developed societies like the United States. So what he has in mind for his theory is he wants to be considering a democracy, a society, large democracy, where people establish government through some sort of voting majority rule, and people have different conceptions of good. So this is the starting point that he's using, that we have these different, we have these disagreements about what is the nature of good life. People have all sorts of conflicting views. Now, what should we do when we have these conflicting views? Now, one obvious idea would be for each group to try to establish the conception of good it thinks is best. I don't mean that the group would try to just conquer all the others by force, but say you had something, say, imagine that Ron Paul was elected president, we had a Congress of people who were like him, then when the thing to do would be to put into effect laws establishing the kind of libertarian society he thought should be established. So wouldn't each group just say, well, I'm going to go according to my conception of good, because after all, that's the one I think is best, so wouldn't that be the one I'd go on to establish? But Rawls thinks if you did that, if you just said, well, here's my conception of good, I'm going to try to put that into effect, that would display lack of respect for other people with other conceptions of good. And why would that, why would you be showing lack of respect for other people? Because even if you think your moral theory is correct, your conception of good is correct, the reasons for it aren't so strong that it would be irrational for someone else to reject it. Now, this is what he calls the fact of reasonable pluralism. As I mentioned, he has these very catchy phrases for things. So this is one that become influential, the fact of reasonable pluralism. So he thinks, well, we have these different, in the developed society, like the US, we have these different conceptions of good, that's pluralism, and it's reasonable pluralism because we don't have a situation in which it's just there's one moral theory. It's just so convincing it would be completely irrational to deny it. Let's say, what would be a good case in something else? Well, supposing, say, we're considering different theories of astronomy. So we don't say, well, there are some people who believe that the Earth is the center of the universe and all the planets, the sun revolve around the Earth. Maybe there are such people, but their position is just so implausible that we really don't have to take account of it. We don't have to accommodate that view. It's just completely wrong. People like that are really crazy in a certain way. They're just not willing to look at the evidence. So we're always saying, well, when we talk about what is nature of good life, the situation isn't like that. It may be that there are good arguments in favor of one conception of good over others, but they're not so absolutely convincing to people that we can say anyone who denies them that theory is just completely off base. We just don't have to take account of that view. So, given the fact or the fact that Rawls takes it, that the conceptions of good aren't rationally compelling, it's wrong, he thinks, to impose the ones you favor on others. So it would be wrong in his view to say, well, I'm just going to try to get a majority of voters to put in the view I want, and then we're going to impose that, make that the law of society. So he said, well, what do you have? Do you show respect for persons? Given the fact of reasonable pluralism, you have to justify your policy by reasons every reasonable person could accept. So if you want to establish a policy, it isn't enough to say, I've got a conception of good that says what I'm doing is the thing to do. I have to be able to show that even if you have a different conception of good, there, at least you could recognize the reasons that I have. You would take those to be reasons also, even if you didn't find them, you didn't accept my conclusion, but at least say, well, I can accept what you're saying as a reason. Now, that sounds a bit abstract, but let me give you, I'll give you some examples that show what we all have in mind. Suppose someone thinks that the Bible forbids same-sex marriage. And of course, we're not concerned here whether that belief is true, maybe, that the Bible does forbid that. I suppose that some people think that it does forbid same-sex marriage. So Rawls would say that even if the majority agrees with this view, say the majority of people think the Bible forbids same-sex marriage, and they go by, they accept the Bible as authoritative, then the majority can't impose that view on others. The majority couldn't pass a law saying we're forbidding same-sex marriage because the Bible, at least the way the Bible as we take it, says that same-sex marriage is wrong. So why couldn't we do this? Because there would be some people who wouldn't accept what the Bible says as a reason. So that would be, if, according to Rawls, if we try to impose this view on others, we wouldn't be respecting them because we wouldn't be giving them the reason we had, namely that the Bible said this was wrong, wouldn't be something they could take as a reason. Now, it doesn't mean, Rawls doesn't mean you have to come up with reasons that absolutely everyone could acknowledge. You only have to provide reasons to reasonable people. And of course, that we need to know what exactly Rawls means by reasonable people. And Rawls calls this process where we argue for positions we hold only giving reasons that every reasonable person could accept, public reasons. So that we have to argue by public reason. We can't appeal exclusively to conceptions of the good that we hold, but that other people didn't share this our conception of good wouldn't accept as a reason. Now, to understand what Rawls said, he said we have to appeal, we have to satisfy all reasonable people in this way. We have to understand what Rawls means by reasonable. Now, he distinguishes between the reasonable and the rational. Now, those of you who studied Mises and human action would be familiar with what he means by rational. Someone is rational if he picks suitable means to achieve his end. Suppose you want to understand what Rawls' theory of justice is. Well, a rational means to that would be to read his books or to read articles about him, possibly to listen to this lecture. They would be ways of meeting your end, of fulfilling your end, of understanding Rawls. It would be good means of doing this. At least reading Rawls would be, I'm not so sure about coming to my lecture. I hope so, but never mind that. So that's what rational action is, one thing. Pick an appropriate means to achieve your end. Now, a reasonable person is you want to come to agreement with others on this basic framework of society. It's with others who share this goal of coming to agreement with all other reasonable people. So I'm re- reasonable if I want to see all these people with different conceptions of good. I'm reasonable. I say, how can I come to an agreement with all these people, assuming those people also want to come to agreement with me and with everyone else who wants to come to an agreement? That's a bit complicated, but I could just get the basic idea. You're talking about reasonable means you want to come to terms with other people. You don't want to start just fighting them. You're trying to come to an agreement with them. So an example of the distinction would be Nazis might be rational in the sense that given the ends they had, they might select effective means to achieve them. But they say, well, they want to establish Germany as supreme power in Europe, so good means to do that would be maybe we could start invading Poland, invading Russia, trying to subdue all these countries. That would be effective means to achieve that end, but we screw up. But the Nazis aren't reasonable. They don't want to come to agreement with people. They just want to come to they just want to conquer them. And I see the question is, the conscientious objector reasonable? Well, I mean, I suppose he could be, but just, see, Rawls is here talking about what the basic structure of society should be. So it depends. I mean, the conscientious objector could think that he wants to come to agreement with people, but he might, if you come to a reasonable agreement with other people, this would leave room for people who object to certain policies of the government in certain cases to not obey the government. So he could say the conscientious objector could be fitted in there. And some of the reason someone wants to avoid conflict. Well, there is some similarity with, I think, with what Hans Hoppe is saying there. It's not precisely saying, I mean, it's more of a something like not just avoiding conflict, but you're actually coming up with some structure of reasons that everyone will accept. So, I mean, I think it's more demanding than just avoiding conflict. So then we have a difficult question. Well, suppose we have the different conceptions of the good. So even if we're talking about reasonable people want to come to agreement, how can we reach an agreement given this fact of reasonable pluralism, this view that people have conceptions of the good, and you can't show that one conception is so overwhelmingly right that you have to be really out of things to reject it. So what Rawls says is that people can establish a basic framework of institutions and rules, and within this framework, people can pursue their own conceptions of good. And within each conception of good, whatever it is, there'll be reasons to accept the framework. So each conception of good will have a reason to accept this basic framework of rules. And Rawls calls this an overlapping consensus. So within each of the conceptions of good, there'll be reasons to accept this general framework. So that's the overlapping consensus. Now, how do we establish what this basic framework is? Well, the fundamental requirement is that the framework, this basic structure of rules and institutions, has to be impartial among different conceptions of good. Because supposing, say, you have a particular conception of good, and you sort of fix the framework so it favors that conception of good, then people with other views, just why would they accept what you say? What we want is some kind of impartiality there, so we won't be favoring one conception of good, because if we did, people with a different conception of good wouldn't have it wouldn't be something that they would want you to agree with, it wouldn't be reasonable. We're trying to reach agreement and to insist that they accept our conceptions of them. And we're trying to reach agreement with some people who have different conceptions of it. So we have to have an impartial framework. So to secure impartiality, Rawls proposes that people decide what he calls the original position, They don't know basic facts about themselves. You don't know what your own abilities are, your preferences, or your conceptions of the good. So people do know facts about how society operates, such as the laws of economics, but you don't know these basic facts about yourself, including conceptions of good. So because you don't know them, or you're assuming that you don't know them, then you're not going to be establishing a system that's biased in favor of particular conceptions, because you don't know what your own conception of good is, so you won't be biased in that way. So Rawls says that people in the original position, because they don't know these things, he said they're behind the veil of ignorance. And these are two of his phrases that have stuck. As they say, he has a gift for coming up with slogans or phrases that have become very influential. We have the original position, the veil of ignorance. Probably many of you have heard those terms before. Now, professor at Harvard has a very popular class called Justice. He's a professor of political science of government at Harvard, and Michael Sandel had an influential objection to Rawls in a book published in 1982 called Liberalism and the Limits of Justice. He objected, the question, how can you decide to do, Eric wants to know, how can you decide to do without knowing what your preference is? Well, we'll find out how Rawls answers that. It's an excellent question, but we'll see in a few minutes how Rawls wants to deal with that. So, Eric, your question is related to this objection that Michael Sandel gave to Rawls. Sandel objected. He said Rawls is assuming what he called an unencumbered self. Encumbrance means you're burdened with something, you have something weighing you down. So he said Rawls is assuming unencumbered self in the sense that we can detach ourselves from our commitments and conceptions of the good. So Rawls is saying, well, here we are in this original position, we're kind of detached, we're assuming that we can exist apart from our particular commitments and conceptions of good. But Sandel says, no, we can't do that. These commitments and conceptions of good are really basic to our identity. I see someone has Aiden points out Sandel has a book for the general public called Justice, and I reviewed that in my Mises review, so I know that because it's a book I think it's certainly worth reading. But I think Sandel's objection really isn't right. And I can tell you, he's well regarded in certain circles in the government department. Among philosophers, he's not too well regarded. I could tell you, they're not going to names because it would just be gossip, but there's certainly at least one very eminent philosopher. Well, I could tell you, two quite eminent philosophers thought Sandel really didn't have much upstairs. I'll mention you, I am pretty much a gossip. One of them was Bob Nozick, and I think Thomas Nagel also doesn't think much of Rawls. I don't really get the impression that I'm a gossip just because I said that. Regardless of what how smart he is, his objection really rests on mistake. Because Rawls doesn't claim that we should view our commitments as detached from ourselves. And Rawls could accept, although he doesn't have to, that such commitments form our identity. all Rawls is asking us to do is engage in a thought experiment, which is designed to portray impartial choice. Rawls isn't suggesting that in real life we can live apart from our commitments or detach from our commitments. I don't think this objection is really a good one, although it's been influential. Now, here we can address the question Eric raised, a very good question. Well, supposing I'm behind the veil of ignorance, I don't know what my choice, what my preferences are, I don't know what my conception of good is, how can I choose? It was just like saying something like asking to pick a meal in a restaurant, but I'm just blank out in my preferences for food. How would I be able to pick anything? So isn't this kind of an odd question that we're all asking? So we're supposed to be choosing, we don't know anything about our preferences. But what Rawls gets out of this and says, well, we know each person is self-interested, we're assuming this, and each person wants to live in accord with his own conception of good, even though he doesn't know what this conception is. But what we persons do know is, regardless of what conception of good he has, you need certain things in order to live a good life. No matter what your conception of good is, you need certain things. And Rawls calls these things primary good. And they include rights and liberties. Say you whatever your conception of good is, you would want to have a freedom of movement. You want to be able to speak and say what you thought. You want to be able to practice whatever religion you thought was best, if you thought if you were religious, or if you weren't, you would want to hold, they were free to hold whatever beliefs you thought were right. You want certain powers and opportunities, you want the chance to be able to do certain things, you wouldn't just want to be completely restricted, you want certain basic freedom of action, and you would also need a certain level of income and wealth, regardless of what your conception of good was. So, in other words, you need a certain amount of the primary good in order to pursue your conception of good. And once you got that amount, getting more won't be as important. It might be you want, say, as much income and wealth as possible, but what you'd be most concerned with be you would get at least a level to income and wealth to pursue your conception good, you at least want some income and wealth. So Rawls thinks that in the original provision, your main goal would be to make sure you got the primary goods you need, and you wouldn't choose some principle of justice that would risk your falling below the necessary level, even if the risky strategy might give you more primary goods. Supposing, say, there was some principle where you would assign income and wealth to people by some kind of lottery where some people could win enormously big prizes. Say, somebody who, if you have a winning ticket in the lottery, could come up with hundreds of millions of dollars, but you might get a losing ticket and get nothing. So you wouldn't pick a principle where income and wealth be distributed that way, because then you would risk that you wouldn't be getting anything. And you know you need income and wealth to pursue your consumption goods, and you wouldn't pick a principle where you might not end up with anything. So what Rawls suggests is, well, what principle would be chosen in the situation where each person wants to get this amount of primary good that he needs to pursue his conception of good, whatever it is. Well, he thinks that in the original position, people will pick a framework in which each person has the maximum amount of rights and liberties consistent with equal rights and liberties for all. rights and liberties that we have in mind include civil liberties such as freedom of speech, religion, right of political participation. Regardless of what your conception of good is, you're not going to pick a system that certain people could be deprived of freedom of speech or freedom to practice their religion. Because what if you ended up in one of these groups that could be prohibited from speaking? Remember, you don't know what your own preferences or what your own conception of good is. So you might be in one of these forbidden groups, forbidden to practice. So you don't know that, so you're not going to pick a principle that says it's all right to restrict people. So Rawls says these rights and liberties that people would choose are what he called lexically prior to the other primary good. They sometimes call it lexicographically prior. What that means is just like in a dictionary, you have all the words beginning with A come before all the words beginning with B, so on. So the rights are lexically prior in that you have to, they come first in the sense that you can't trade off rights to get gains in some of the other things that are lowered down on the primary good list, such as income and wealth. I'll give you an example. Now, the socialists, communists, used to claim, of course their claim turned out to be absolutely wrong, but they used to claim, well, even if you don't have, say, in the Soviet Russia isn't a very free society, but communism is much more productive than capitalism. People actually thought that at one point. Some people thought that, of course, completely wrong. Some people thought that. But Rawls wouldn't accept that sort of argument because he would be saying even though the society doesn't recognize these freedom of speech or political freedom, well, they're still all better than we are because then you get more income and wealth, supposing that were true. Rawls would say, no, you can't do that because these rights are lexically prior. Now, this is, I think, the most crucial thing to understanding what Rawls' system. When you talk about these equal rights, these rights are lexically prior, they don't include property rights. Now, if individuals have the right to acquire property, this is one of the basic rights people have, then there would be no place in Rawls' system for egalitarian redistribution, which he favors. So Rawls has really set up his system so that income and wealth counts only the primary good that ranks below rights and liberty. Now you might say, if you say, well, why do you do that? Aren't you banging the question against libertarianism? You might say, well, the libertarian view would be rejected by some people, so this is a particular conception that we can't put in. Some people don't accept property rights, but the trouble with that is his position is also one that many people, such as libertarians, would reject. So he's really assuming, but hasn't really argued, that people don't have the right to acquire property as one of these equal rights and liberties that have lexical priorities. I think that's really a fundamental criticism of his system. Now, we could then ask, suppose we accept Rawls's view, I don't think we should, but suppose we accept Rawls's view that property rights aren't in this lexical prior group, why won't people in the original position choose to establish a libertarian system of property? Why won't they say, well, the system we're going to set up is one just like the libertarian system where people can just homestead property and then trade what they acquired with other people? Rawls calls this free market system the system of natural liberty. And he thinks people wouldn't choose it because it's too risky. He thinks that you might end your system of natural liberty on the free market, couldn't you end up without much income or wealth? What if you just didn't have abilities that other people valued highly? You might not do very well in the free market. What would we do instead? One suggestion is that people would choose to have an equal distribution of wealth and income. See, in that way, you could be sure you would have at least as much as anybody else. So remember, Rawls has strong moral intuitions that equality is a good thing. We would tend not to have such intuitions, but he does. So he says, well, one thing you could do is choose to, say, have an equal distribution of wealth and income. But this leads to a problem. Remember, people, even though they don't know their own preferences, they do know general facts about society. And they would know that if people chose equality, then they would know that they might not have, if they turned out to be very productive, they might not have much incentive to produce as much as they would if inequalities were allowed. Suppose you were living in a system with complete equality and you're very productive, then you might not want to produce very much because you know anything you produce that goes beyond the average will just be distributed to other people. And so Rawls here is not, remember, he's not assuming that people outside the original position are motivated by egalitarian concerns. He thinks, as he talks about, he calls the strains of commitment. He thinks that the system you come up with has to be one that people could be motivated to accept in their actual state of life. And probably people really wouldn't, especially very productive people, wouldn't really be inclined to accept it. They'd be very uncomfortable with a system of absolute equality. They wouldn't want to produce much. So this is the basic problem there with the suggestion that of having equal distribution. So Rawls then seems to have a big problem. He says people want to make sure they have enough income and wealth. One way to do that seems to be to have equal distribution. But a rule that just mandates equality would probably result in less wealth and income that one allows inequality. So the tension in the system is saying, well, we want to have equality because we want to make sure that no one comes out really not getting much. But if we do that, maybe we'll probably have a much less productive society if we allow inequality. So he resolves this tension through the second part of the difference bill. So the first part, you won't go into just covers equality of opportunity. So the second part of the difference principle is that all inequalities have to be to the advantage of the least well-off group in society. So if you allow inequality to the advantage of the least well-off group, you're assured that, remember, you're in your position, you don't know how you're going to turn out, you know that you'll do at least as well as you would have done under equality. Because otherwise, the second part of the difference principle wouldn't be fulfilled. Now, it might turn out, if the difference principle might turn out, that a rule that allowed unlimited property acquisition with no compulsory distribution would be to the advantage of the least well-off group. Say if you believe that the free market would be vastly better for the poor than interventionist to a welfare state, then you would think that the difference principle will favor the free market. Then you'd have a Rawlsian argument for the system of natural liberty. But this isn't the way Rawls took the argument. There are, Will Wilkinson, who's a libertarian and used to work at Cato Institute, wanted to use a Rawlsian argument for libertarian, just the way I mentioned. And he and people like him were called Rawls sections because they wanted to combine Rawls with Hayek. But Rawls doesn't take it this way. Rawls supported somewhat of a welfare state or market socialism. But you wouldn't have to do that if it would depend on what view you had of the what would best help the least well-off group. Well, okay, I think that'll end the lecture. I'm also will take questions. I want to deal. I think there were some comments people had first that I didn't answer yet in the, let me just get to them. Lucas says, if the laws of economics are deduced from the action axiom, then you can have a moral theory that's irrational to reject a moral theory of self-ownership. What makes it irrational to impose a view? Well, this is a very interesting point, Lucas, to be raising. Now, there is an argument. I don't think it would be one based on just on the theory of international. There is an argument, say, that Tom Coppa gives, and I think he thinks that you can show that there is an argument that should be rationally compelling that says that shows that a libertarian system is correct. And I think what Rawls would say to that is, well, even if this argument is right, it isn't so convincing that no one, you'd have to be absolutely really out of your mind to reject. I mean, he thinks that views aren't that convincing, but I mean, I suppose somebody could just deny that and say, no, maybe that view is that convincing, people just reject it or wrong. Now, what I'm inclined to say myself, I'd object to Rawls a bit differently. I think when he says that it's wrong to impose a conception of good on others, I think it would depend on what it is you're wanting to impose on others. It's impose in the sense that you'd be establishing that as the rule in society, regardless of what other people didn't want it. I mean, I think Rawls is right. Suppose we said we believe we have a true religion, it would be wrong to force other people to say, well, you can't go to your church, or you have to go to our church. But if, say, you held that libertarian property right should be established, I don't think you could say you're showing lack of respect for people who don't accept that view to say that we're going to establish this system even if you prefer a socialist system. I don't think that doesn't seem to me to be a violation of the rights of conscience in the same way that interfering with people's freedom of religion would be. So I think there is a real question there. I think that you have to make a difference. It makes a difference what it is we want to put in when we talk about a conception of good. And now, okay, you see, I answered that one already. Wait a sec here. Lucas says, is the veil of ignorance similar to Singer's moral vacuum? I'm not really sure of what Singer's moral vacuum is. Maybe you could tell me what he had in mind with that. Now, Aiden asking the question, if I think I need X, Y, or Z to have a good life, don't I prefer to have some conception of good already? Well, Rawls thinks no. He thinks you just need these particular things regardless of your conception of good. I mean, maybe we could come up with exceptions, but I'm supposing you had some conception of good where you should leave an ascetic life, you should just become a monk or a hermit, then maybe be wrong to think you need income or wealth. So maybe Rawls's primary good does bias the case against certain conceptions of good. But his general idea is you need primary goods regardless of the conception of good you have. So he thinks you really don't need a conception good to recognize that you want primary good. And Rawls who said a justified is one which you want to be born in no matter what hand you were dealt. I don't think he said that. It doesn't sound like that would be plausible. I mean, you know, in any society there's going to be people who are very, at least realistically conceived society, where people are going to end up in very bad states of affairs. I mean, maybe you could modify that and say you wouldn't be treated unjustly regardless of what hand you were dealt. I mean, we wouldn't want to say a just society would be one, say, with no people who were born with birth defects. We wouldn't want severe birth defects. We wouldn't want to say that that's a requirement of a just society, but it might be the case that people with certain birth defects wouldn't want to be born if they've had a choice. I'm not saying that's okay, that's true, but I mean, we could certainly think this. I don't think that would be right. Jacques says, because you can't defend property whose rank takes some away. Yes, I think that's one reason Rawls doesn't put property as a right, because that would ruin its whole idea of redistribution. Remember, you have strong egalitarian views. And one thing we'll be getting into next week, you might talk about Tom Nagel, the very common view among egalitarians is they think property is just conventional. What property rights we have are just established by society. They don't accept the notion of natural property rights. I was wrong. It was slightly different. They would agree. Rawls is saying that. I'm sorry, I was constructing now, I'm not clear. You're right, Brian. Rawls does say that, but I'm not sure why would a self-interested disembodied soul agree to be born in a society knowing he might be dealt with a lousy social genetic hand. You're right, Rawls does say that, but I'm not seeing why that's plausible. I have to read what Rawls says about it. It just doesn't seem plausible to me. Aiden says, Rawls theory assumes people are risk averse, but it's not a universal truth. Some people are risk seeking. Well, what Rawls says is, it's a very interesting question, really. See, when you have, this is, you're deciding under conditions of uncertainty. I say you can't calculate the probability. You know that there are various places you could end up, but you don't know what the odds are that you'll be in any of them, because we're depriving people of this information. So what Rawls said, in those cases where we're uncertain, he thinks he can show that the rational course of action is what he calls a maximum criterion. Let me put that in here. So he says, what we want to do is, that didn't work, what did I do here? Or did it work? So what this is we're trying to maximize the worst possible outcome. He thinks it follows from certain principles of game theory that would be the rational thing to do. So he would say to you, if people were chose a riskier strategy, he would just say, you're being irrational in risking that. You won't be getting this minimum amount of primary goods that you need to pursue your own life, your own conception of good. Now, Brian doesn't agree with that assessment. I'm not sure what assessment that is. Brian says, risking your liberty is different from risking your property. Well, you see, that's one reason Rawls thinks that what we would care about is just getting a certain amount of income and wealth. It isn't that we're insisting on having them, giving up the most property we could in the original position. We're just choosing a rule that will give us as much, either equal distribution to everyone else or better. See, because the second part of the difference principle says inequalities have to be advantage of the least well-off group. So we'll be assured that we'll all be doing at least as well as we were under the equal distribution. I missed something here. The difference principle has a fundamental flaw. If everyone's society is already pretty rich, and always getting the least well off, so that's a priority. Well, not the way Rawls is taking it. It would just be whatever the least well off is in that society. So he isn't assuming, you know, this is a very good question, point you raise. He isn't assuming that people are really badly off. Say we have an idea that, imagine, say, some people are just not able to function at all. They have illnesses, so they can't do any work. He's thinking that those people really aren't covered in the original position at all. He's assuming that everyone has something, is productive, so we're considering how do we distribute the gains from social cooperation. So he's assuming that everyone is making some contribution, and then he's thinking, well, the people who wouldn't know they're in the less productive group would pick this kind of rule, assuring that they did as well as they could. So as far as people who are really in a very badly off state of affairs, so people can't produce at all, we all think we have moral obligations to help them, but they aren't covered by the theory of justice at all. That would just be something that we have certain moral duties to them. But they don't come in to the difference principle, really. If we're talking about, the lower third of people in the income distribution. Okay, then we talk about, I think there's some discussion relative versus absolute levels. Well, what Rawls is talking about is really just more relative levels, like who's the least productive within a given society. He's not talking about people who are really absolutely badly off. Now, here's a question from Leslie. Suppose a frame would benefit the least working poor, but not the people who don't want to work, or the least well off. Well, I think Rawls is assuming, again, that here that people, he's talking about people who are making gains, everyone is benefiting from their cooperation. People who are kind of a total drag on society or aren't really being considered in this basic framework. So I think they're handled under charity. I see on Singer saying people have to act in a way that doesn't make you better off, it makes everyone better off. That would be kind of an appeal to a kind of general universalizability requirement. So I think Rawls might accept that, but it's different from the veil of ignorance because that isn't assuming that you don't know anything about yourself. It's just saying what you do should make everyone better off. Yes, that's right. Ryan's pointing out Rawls' theories in general knowledge, economics, and society. So people would assume, be aware of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Yeah, they would be aware, if that was one of the generally accepted theories, they would be aware of that, I guess. In terms of legal consideration of interest. Well, Lucas, you see, here's a basic difference between Rawls and Singer. In Rawls' system, you're not considering everyone equal consideration of interest because, remember, it's you're considering what would, in the second part of differences, so you're considering what's to the advantage of least well-off group. So supposing you had it, you're considering two distributions. One would make the least well-off group better off than the other one would be, but in the other one, even though the least well-off group would be do not as well as in the first distribution, everybody else would be better off than they would in the first distribution. So you would have one group say the least well-off would be best, would do best, but say everybody else wouldn't. Well, let's give an example. Let's make it more concrete. Supposing we had first system, everybody has completely equal distribution. And the other one, say it's a free market system where there's a least well-off group that isn't doing as well as everyone in the first group because, remember, first of everyone has equal distribution, but the least well-off group is somewhat, let's say, slightly below that, but everybody else is quite a bit better off. So the principle is considered equal consideration of interest. You might think the second society is better, but Rawls would have to say the first one is. So it would be a bit different. Okay, now here's a question. Now, this is a very interesting question. M.R. is at, Orlovsky is asking, well, supposing in a libertarian society, people don't have positive duties to others, so isn't each person then free to pursue his own conception of good? So isn't this what Rawls is talking about? Well, see, that's a very good point, but see, I think what Rawls would say to that is that we still need to have some way of establishing what the distribution of property is. And he wouldn't accept this system, what he called natural liberty, libertarian system. But he said that isn't what he thinks, that isn't what we choose in the original position. So you're right, the libertarian system does fulfill to some extent what he means by not interfering with each person's pursuit of conception of good. But he's not satisfied with the property system. Has anyone logically disproven these as an author? Well, I certainly hope not. I don't think so. I would very much doubt that because I accept both of what they say. I'm not aware of any logical disproof of them. Okay, so we have some discussions. Rothbard is an anarchist, that's right. Okay, so we have a few more minutes. Do we have more questions? Should be a little bit more. Wait. Leslie asks, how did Rawls respond to Nozick's criticism? Well, he didn't have too much to say in response to Nozick. Nozick in the second part of chapter 7, Vanity of Utopia, is one of the best criticisms, probably the best criticism of Rawls. What he basically said, I think, was that that Nozick was just by just not taking account, he said Nozick had criticized him for thinking that people's abilities are the people, when Rawls said that was one thing I didn't deal with in the lecture, but Rawls said we don't deserve to benefit from our superior abilities because these just come about as a result of luck. So we can't say, according to Rawls, oh, Tiger Woods said, well, I should be able to earn more than other people because other people, I'm much better golfer than everybody else. And he said, well, it was until recently, and people want to pay me, so I should be able to profit from my superior talent. Rawls said, well, it was just a matter of luck that he happened to be talented. So Nozick said, well, but then Rawls is acting as if people's abilities belong to the collective. And isn't this inconsistent with individual liberty? And Rawls said, no, he's not assuming that abilities, that collective own everyone, that people don't own their own abilities, just saying they shouldn't be able to profit from them to the maximum extent possible. I think that kind of a weak response, but that was what he said. But Nozick thought, he used to complain that Rawls didn't respond very much. He said people were always attacking Nozick. They said Nozick doesn't respond to criticism, but he said, well, they don't attack Rawls, and he didn't really respond to what Nozick said. Now, Brian, so the answer could be no, everyone else is wrong. And what would the question be? Now, Amy said, doesn't Rawls ignore downplay issues and merit and desert? Abby's nothing to do with justice. Well, I should have gone into this a bit more, but what he says is that you don't really deserve to profit, as I say, you don't deserve to profit from your abilities because they just arise as a matter of luck. Just happen to be born with a good set of genes, you could environment, good parent. So you can't, in his view, really say that you deserve to earn more because you have superior abilities. So he doesn't think merit and desert have much to do with justice, although that seems an improbable view, but that was what he said. Yes, I mean, there are people who have arguments against using Rothbard. I just don't find them convincing, but there are certainly people who have arguments against them, right? Let me see. Charles says, objection, merit, and desert sound like quoting argument, denying second difference. Well, you see, the way Rawls used rejection, merit, and desert, it wasn't so much in building up his own theory, but in replying to those who objected to him that you're not allowing the people who produce more deserve to get more, to profit from their abilities. And so he was using this denial of merit and desert really as a defensive measure against what these other people were proposing. You're right that luck, egalitarianism, it's called, comes in much more directly in Cohen's theory. But for Rawls, it was more of a defensive measure against those like Nozick and others who objected to him. Now, Eric is wanting to know why you would, she thought since people would always choose what makes the worst off better, he would prefer kind of more risky thing. Well, I think the reason is, again, that Rawls is thinking under these conditions of uncertainty, we're going to choose what makes sure we have enough of the primary goods. We'll prefer this because we don't want to have a chance of getting being left with not enough to pursue our conception of good. Now, people have argued just the way you do and said they think people would, Eric had to say people would choose it, be willing to put up with more risk than people argue just the way you do. But this wasn't the way what Rawls thought. I mean, this is one of the most contested points. The video stopped. Okay. Yes, Leslie said, people who work hard have been lucky. That's right. He says that really what his position there is, I've had some discussion with, I had my own interpretation of this, Tom Nagel thought I was right on this. What Rawls thinks is, supposing you're deciding whether you want to work hard. So your decision whether you want to work hard will depend a lot on what abilities you have. Suppose you're not very talented and can't do much, then it won't really be rational for you to work very hard. So he thinks it isn't so much that you're not responsible for how hard you work, but he thinks it won't really be rational to work hard if you don't have superior abilities, and that's having superior abilities is a matter of luck. We had some discussion of argumentation. Well, we were discussing argumentation ethics in the last lecture. Well, Eric gives an example here, but remember, you're not doing it at a level of $1. It's just you're picking just what would give you a certain level of the primary goods of the income and wealth. So you're not having to do it at this very small level that's coming into your example. Okay, well, I guess we're about out of time now. So thanks to everybody for coming to the lecture. Hope we'll see you all next week. Thanks very much, everybody.